Ryan Seacrest here. Every great barbecue has one secret ingredient. Patience. You do a little, and you wait a little. And while your dinner does its thing, you got a few minutes to yourself, right? Well, kick back with a little Chumba Casino. A flip and a spin. Who knows? Maybe even a login bonus. It is the perfect recipe. Chumba Casino. Always good to have you back.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is The Big Breakdown. A long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
In a courtroom in Utah, Corey Richin watched her story fall apart. Every day, another witness testified, another text message read on the record, another piece of the life she constructed crumbled under examination. The friend who says Corey told her it would be better if Eric were dead, or that she said that too. The financial records showing the $250,000 HELOC Eric didn't know about, the boyfriend she was allegedly texting while her husband was still alive, the search history, the fentanyl. One by one, the bricks came loose. You can watch it happen in real time if you go back and look at the trial coverage. The controlled exterior giving way. The narrative she built becoming impossible to maintain. That's the unraveling. It looks different for everyone, but it always comes. The long con always ends, not because investigators are brilliant. They certainly weren't in this case, but because secrets require everyone to cooperate forever. And forever is a very long time. This is part five of The Perfect Wife, final episode in this series. And the one, this is for anyone who's ever watched a house of lies collapse, who's seen the moment when someone's carefully constructed reality starts cracking at the seams. And I'd love to get your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube and Substack. The links are in the descriptions right now. Hit subscribe while you're there. Denise Williams held it together for 18 years. That's longer than most marriages last. Longer than most people can keep any secret at all. For nearly two decades, she lived a completely normal life. Raised her daughter, went to work, paid her bills, got remarried, all while sitting on the knowledge of what she'd done. She collected $1.75 million in life insurance. She married the man who helped her kill her first husband. And every single day for 18 years, she woke up, went to sleep, and did it all again. She must have believed after a while that she'd actually gotten away with it. December 16th of 2000, Mike Williams wakes up early. It's his sixth wedding anniversary with Denise, his high school sweetheart, the love of his life. They have a daughter together, just a baby. They have plans to celebrate that evening. A nice dinner. Reconnecting. The kind of date night young parents dream about. But first, Mike is going duck hunting with his best friend, Brian Winchester. They've been friends since childhood. Best friends. The kind of friendship that survives adolescence and college and the transition into adulthood. When Mike and Denise got married, Brian was there. He's part of the fabric of their lives. Mike leaves before dawn. Denise kisses him goodbye. She'll see him that evening. Happy anniversary. Be safe. He never comes home. His boat is found abandoned on Lake Seminole. Search teams look for days. They drag the lake. They walk the shoreline. They find nothing. The official explanation. I don't know why the Alexa's responding to that, but it is. The official explanation, Mike drowned. His body was eaten by alligators. Lake Seminole had plenty of them. Case closed. Denise is devastated, everyone says so. She plays the grieving widow perfectly. The shock, the tears, the slow acceptance. She has a baby to raise. So she has to stay strong. She pushes to have Mike declared dead. Normally you'd wait 5 years, but Denise petitions the court and gets it done in 6 months. She needs closure, she says. She needs to move on. She needs the insurance money to raise her daughter. $1.75 million. That's what Mike's life was worth on paper. And for 17 years, that's where the story ended. Tragic accident, terrible loss, young widow rebuilding her life. But Mike's mother, Cheryl, never accepted it. And I want you to understand what Cheryl Williams went through, because her story is the other side of this. The person who knows the truth and can't get anyone to believe it. She talked to alligator experts. She learned that alligators don't feed in December. It's too cold. Their metabolism slows. The official story about her son being eaten didn't make biological sense. She started asking questions, writing letters, putting up flyers, running newspaper ads year after year, asking for information about her son's disappearance. And year after year, people told her to move on. Your son drowned, they said. It's been investigated. There's nothing more to find. You're making this harder on yourself. You need to accept reality. For 17 years, Cheryl Williams was told she was crazy, paranoid, unable to let go, a grieving mother who'd lost touch with reality because she couldn't accept her son's death. Guess what? She was right the whole time. Here's what actually happened on December 16th, 2000. Denise Williams and Brian Winchester had been having an affair before Mike died. Well, Mike was building a life with Denise while he was celebrating anniversaries and raising a baby. His wife and his best friend were effing behind his back. They planned the murder together. The original plan was to make it look like a drowning, push Mike out of the boat, hold him under, let the lake do the rest. An accident, a tragedy, nothing anyone could prove. But Mike was strong. When Brian tried to drown him, Mike fought back. He struggled. He tried to get out of his waders and swim, so Brian shot him in the face. He dragged Mike's body to the shore, put it in his truck, drove to a boat landing near Carr Lake, less than an hour from where Cheryl Williams would spend the next 17 years looking for answers, and buried him. Then he went home, cleaned up, and went about his life. And Denise collected the insurance. 5 years later, long enough to avoid suspicion, Brian Winchester married Denise Williams, his best friend's widow, his partner in murder. I mean, think about what that means. Think about the daily reality of that life. You killed your best friend. You buried him in the woods. You married his wife. And now you're raising his daughter together, eating dinner at the same table, celebrating holidays, building a life on top of a grave with a straight face, performing normalcy to everyone else around you. That takes a special type of person, doesn't it? And boy, were these two peas in a pod. Mike's daughter grew up calling her father's killer dad. She had no idea. How could she? She was a baby when it happened. For 10 years, Brian and Denise lived as husband and wife. They built a home. They went to church. They attended neighborhood barbecues and school events and all the ordinary moments that make up an ordinary life. And underneath it all, underneath every single day, was the knowledge of what they'd done. The long con requires you to carry that weight forever. You can never slip. You can never tell anyone. You can never have too much to drink and say something you shouldn't. You can never fight with your spouse and threaten to expose them. You can never crack. For 17 years, Denise Williams didn't crack. But Brian Winchester did. In 2016, Denise filed for divorce. The marriage had been struggling. They'd grown apart. She wanted out. And Brian panicked. Think about what happens when you split up with someone who knows you murdered her first husband. With the thing that bound you together, the secret, the crime, the shared guilt, become something they might use against you. What happens in a custody battle when one party knows the other helped commit murder? What happens when the divorce gets ugly? When lawyers start digging? When everything you've hidden for 17 years becomes leverage in a negotiation? Brian couldn't handle it. And on August 5th of 2016, he kidnapped Denise at gunpoint, forced her into a car. He wasn't trying to kill her, at least that's what he'd later claim. He was terrified, desperate, trying to figure out a way forward that didn't end with him in prison. It didn't work. He was arrested for kidnapping. And now Brian Winchester was facing 20 years. Investigators were taking a fresh look at a case that had been cold for almost two decades. Mike Williams' name was in the news again. The math became simple. His survival mattered more than their secret. And Brian confessed to everything. He led investigators to Mike Williams' body. They found him at Carr Lake, exactly where Brian said he'd be, less than an hour from where Cheryl Williams had been searching for 17 years. Denise Williams was arrested in May of 2018. At trial, Brian testified against her immunity from murder charges in exchange for his cooperation. He described the planning, the affair, the insurance policies. He's explained that one of Mike's policies was about to lapse, that they had to act when they did, or they'd lose the money. Our window of opportunity was closing, he said. The prosecutor's summary was simple. Sex, lies, and deceit. The jury convicted Denise in less than a day. Cheryl Williams sat in that courtroom and watched 17 years of being told she was crazy, 17 years of fighting for an investigation that everyone said was unnecessary. Her son had been murdered by his wife and his best friend. They'd buried him in the woods and built a life on his insurance money, and they'd gotten away with it for almost two decades, but not forever. That's the thing about secrets. They require everyone to cooperate indefinitely. The accomplice has to stay loyal. The witnesses have to stay quiet. The loose ends have to stay tied. Brian Winchester loved Denise enough to kill for her. Loved her enough to bury his best friend in the woods and lie about it for 17 years. Loved her enough to marry her and raise Mike's daughter as his own. But when the choice came down to her freedom or his, he chose himself. That's how these things always end, not with brilliant detective work or dramatic confessions born of guilt, just simple human self-preservation. My survival matters more than our secret. Corey Richens just watched that equation play out in her own case. People talking, the friend who testified about what Corey said, the witness coming forward with pieces of the puzzle, the texts and records, and all the evidence that accumulates when you live a double life. Every long con has a witness. People who saw something, who heard something, who noticed something off, and every one of those people is a potential crack in the foundation. The silence holds until it doesn't, and then everyone talks at once. Mike Williams is buried property now, with his real name on the headstone. His mother can visit his grave. His daughter knows the truth about what happened to her father and who raised her in his place. It took 17 years, but the long con came undone. They always do. Your thoughts in the comment section. on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the description. We'll continue our conversation there. I look forward to it. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're getting podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeart, wherever it may be. Get on your phone, search our podcast, and hit subscribe. Do it right now. So you got us in the car when you get out there later. If you've not already done it, if you're listening to us on the podcast platform, hit subscribe. We do appreciate that. All right. We'll continue our conversation there in the comments. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
We have a lot to break down today as we do a little review of the case of Corey Richens. We're going to talk all about the psychological end of the whole case, from Corey to Eric, how it all played out, why it all worked the way it did. But we're going to begin today with a video because I found it's rather interesting to look back on this case at certain aspects now that the prism has aligned itself to show that she is, in fact, guilty, that a jury of her peers found that she was lying her ass off the entire time, including to Good Day Utah or whatever the hell the program was, where Corey goes on, and we've all heard about it. We've all seen clips of this where Corey is promoting her children's book, Are You With Me? Seeing it from this perspective, knowing that all of it was a lie, is really interesting. So I want to bring in Robin Drake, our co-host, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, and Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author of this book right here. It's Nightbird, available wherever books are sold. And break down, and then we're going to play the video, and we're going to kind of work our way through it, stop, because there's just a lot of interesting observations that I know I was making, and I'd love to get your guys' opinions on what we are seeing as we go through this video. And as we watch this, you guys in the comments section, please do weigh in with your thoughts on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the descriptions, and we'll try and get through your comments and your questions as we work through this. So let's begin with this, Todd, and let's just go right into the video, and then we'll stop here at a certain point, and I'm going to throw it over to you guys to get your thoughts. So Corey Richens, this is her, I believe. Do we have it, the video, ready?
Yep, here we go.
Okay. This is her on that Good Day Utah program promoting the book. What do we got? Do we
have audio? To helping kids cope with grief. And Corey, I want to start with your story. What happened in your personal life?
So my husband passed away unexpectedly last year. So it's March 4th was a 1-year anniversary for us. And he was 39. It completely took us all by shock. And we have 3 little boys, 10, 9, and 6. And, you know, my kids and I kind of wrote this book on the different emotions and grieving processes that we've experienced last year. And
let's pause for a second. My kids and I wrote this book on the various grieving processes we've been experiencing this past year. All lie. She didn't write the book. It was a ghostwriter. But she's the first thing out of her mouth to the folks at the TV station is we wrote the book and it helped with the grieving process. Siobhan, I want to start with you. What are we watching here?
Lying, impression management. You know, she wants to look like someone we should all have empathy and compassion for. And I really don't understand. You see people do this a lot of celebrities, the whole ghostwriter thing. Mm-hmm. And then they win book awards and go on shows and talk about, the process of writing. And then when you get under the surface, they didn't write the damn book. I wrote my own book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
so
it's a children's weird. Book too. It's not like you'd be really, I mean, illustration, if that's not your thing, you know, at the time AI really wasn't out yet. So like you couldn't really, but I mean, you could have written the damn book. It's a children's book. There's like a sentence on a page. It's like, it's less than two paragraphs at the end of the day. So then to say that, you know, this is an exercise in healing and grief. And I, if you did it, cool. That's nice. It's unique. You know, but obviously you didn't do it. Robin, obviously we're only 10 seconds in, but what's your initial feelings here?
Yeah. So what we do when we first observe situations like this is we take in what we're seeing and we automatically start baselining, and we baseline what we're normal, what their normal is in the situation. And what you normally do when you're watching an interview or doing an interview or watching someone engage, typically they start with a baseline so you can get what comfort looks like in someone. And then you can see what we're seeing from an escalation for discomfort or grief or emotions. But they kind of hit it right off the bat of kind of hit it right on the grief process and what the book was written about, right? So you expect to see something other than a casual kind of baseline, because a lot of times it's not just what we see, it's what we don't see. And so for everyone watching this and listening and tuning in, this is what I was doing when I first looked at this video. Not just do your own thought experiment on what you would feel like or expect to see or what you would feel like in those moments, because that's what deep empathy is, which she is lacking, which our viewers are definitely commenting on. But do this. Compare and contrast what you see from her now, talking about the death of her husband and most importantly, as a mother talking about her kids grieving. Does it look any different than any other emotion she gave in court? Does it look any different from anything you're seeing else? In other words, what I'm seeing is a bandwidth of empathy, nonverbal empathy, of about zero.
Yeah.
So it's what we're not seeing. We're not seeing any sort of affect of any impact emotionally on her at all. And she has them. But her emotional impact, the only time you see anything anywhere here or in court or anywhere else, is when it impacts her.
Yeah.
So that's the baseline I saw at the beginning.
The flat affect on this interview is really what got me and through the whole thing. It's like you're really talking about something very emotional. It's not like this is a book on your favorite, you know, sushi rolls or something. Like this is about death. This is about helping and just talking about it like, nothing. Okay, let's go back to the video. Let's watch a chunk of it here and let's all absorb what we're about to see. Continue on.
That it can kind of help other kids, you know, deal with this and kind of, you know, find happiness some way or another.
And to make sense and process, I'm sure. And I'm sure you felt that going through and trying to explain it and articulate it for you and your boys.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And so I've done, you know, I'm new to all of this. So kind of doing, you know, research and reading books and things to try and understand, you know, not only how to grieve as a widow, as a wife, but also, you know, with my kids, how to help them understand what just happened. And what I have kind of found is, as I mentioned, it's kind of the three C's is how I has visualize it. And it's, you know, connection, continuity, and care. And it's, you know, making sure connection is the one major one, and making sure that their spirit is always alive in your home, you know, and memories are always brought up, and doing things that your loved ones love to do, whether it's riding bikes or their favorite dinner, and just constantly, you know, talking about them. And
Corey, do you mention at dinner, here's dad, or dad would like this meal, or dad would, let's bring dad on a bike ride?
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, explaining to my kid, just because he's not present here with us physically, that doesn't mean his presence isn't here with us, and he's doing these things with us, and he's, you know, here for birthdays, and he's here for Christmas, and, you know, and it's just comforting to them to know that, you know, they're not living this life alone. Like, dad is still here. It's just in a different way, a different way.
Well, I opened up your book, and one of the first pages I saw.
Got the three C's going on here, the connection, continuity, and care. I want to ask you, Siobhan, what you're taking here, because I want to see if my take on this is right. It's interesting. The hosts are almost kind of telling her how to feel at the beginning.
Yeah, no kidding. They're
like filling in the blanks. Yes, this is how I should be feeling. But It's interesting to me because what I see here, I mean, as monstrous as it seems to be what Corey did is monstrous, but the fact that I think we're seeing a very raw moment of her where she doesn't know what to feel or how to feel because she's incapable of feeling it. She's having to read books to learn how to feel. She's flat out saying it like, I was reading books, how to grieve as a wife. Now, I mean, I think a lot of us who go through traumas, we turn to books, we turn to things to help us process it and work through it. But it's almost like she's looking for the guidebook. How do the rest of the humans handle something like this? How should I be acting like this? Because I don't naturally do it. What was your take there?
Yeah, it's like she's role-playing. She's trying to pretend to be someone with empathy and compassion, which, as everybody says, she does not have that.
Yeah.
But it's this impression management, which goes into the narcissism, you know, and also the Machiavellianism, this strategic way of thinking. And people like that study other people to try to figure out, how do I put on the mask of normalcy here?
Mm-hmm.
And how do I do it? And it sounds like almost a very conscious attempt on her part. Sometimes they're not conscious that they're doing it, but it sounds conscious for her. It's like, I need to play a role here. How do I do it? And I'll bet those three C's came from the ghostwriter because did not come from her.
And I'm going to bet, like, there's an obliviousness to her speaking these words that other people don't feel this need, don't feel this, let me go get a book to tell me how I should be. We just have it, but she's needing. And the thing is, and this is interesting because there's a ton of people who do lack empathy, who that is low on their feeling scale or non-existent. You have it with a lot of folks with Asperger's and on the autism scale, where it's an emotion that is sometimes hard to feel and hard to empathize and understand how other people are feeling. It doesn't turn them into Corey Richens and murderers. But they do have to take some cues from learned behavior and go, oh, if you want to integrate with the rest of society and not always kind of be off here on the side looking odd, this is how people act. And many people are able to do that and function and interact with society in some way, shape, or form. And sometimes they're faking it till they make it to a certain extent, but they're able to fit in and go, okay, even though I am lacking over here, this is, I've learned over time, this is how people act. And they get along just fine. And then you got the Coreys, which is very different. Robin, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, and I'm curious what Siobhan thinks about this too, because it's a thought, and I'm curious about your thoughts on this. She was also using the word, and I couldn't tell whether it was a filler word, because she says you know a lot, you know, which is a filler word for people. But she's also using kind of. And when I heard her first use kind of, it's in reference to her feelings, her emotions, and what the purpose of the book is. It's kind of this, it's kind of this. I wasn't quite sure whether she's using it as a filler word or she really wasn't quite sure the purpose of what she was doing or the book, which goes to the whole point of she's not really emotionally connected to that book. She didn't even have empathy for what she wrote. So Siobhan, did you see it as a filler or as a word modifier for her emotion?
I think you nailed it with the second, although she did use, you know, constantly, which was driving
me
crazy.
Right, that is right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that means the person is trying to grasp at what they want to say because they're not really sure what they want to say. So they're doing that with this little delay here for what am I going to say here? But yeah, the lack of connection, the lack of affect, as Tony said, with it is really striking. And yes, it just speaks to me that she's trying to, what is the right thing to say here? What am I supposed to say? What's the response I'm supposed to give?
And again, so she had two of them. She had, you know, and kind of. She used kind of a lot.
Yeah.
And there's only one other visual thing I saw, and I didn't have time to really research this. Again, it's just an impression I got. And I'm curious your thoughts on this. When she held up her hands, she's not wearing a wedding ring. So there would have been, it's not that she had to, but I noticed things that stand out. And I've known people that have lost spouses and yet they'll wear that wedding ring for quite a while until they have found someone else. And now we know in hindsight she was cheating and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But you would think if she was that good at strategic thinking, it would have made a big empathetic play on the audience had she actually kept her wedding ring on.
Yeah, that was a really good catch. I missed that one. But that's true. People wear those wedding rings for years often, and that just shows the bond that they had. And I would guess she took it off the morning after and was ready to
move on. Sold. It's already sold.
Yeah. It's like already on eBay right after she's putting the bottle down that she's pouring. Okay, mule's done, ring off. Here you go, Eric.
Yes, even my mother-in-law, I mean, when my father-in-law passed, I mean, she wore the rings for a very long time, you know, until she found someone else finally.
Yeah. It's hard to take it off.
It is, especially if there's a connection.
Exactly. It's the loss of the connection. But it also makes me think she's trying to think strategically, as she did with all her business wheeling and dealing, but she's not very good at it.
Yes.
And I wanted to hit on that too, Siobhan, because I'm really curious about your impression of her skill set at this, because if she is, I mean, she had a lifetime of learning how and practicing manipulation. And part of that is that perception management and knowing, like you said earlier, that she has to present what people are expecting her to present emotionally, yet she seems to be completely sucking at it. Do you think this was like a new revelation that she has to present something, or do you think this is just she's got zero skill set to even learn that capacity?
This may sound blunt, but I'll go ahead and say it because it's just what keeps coming back into my mind as I watch her and hear more about her story and all the missteps. She's not the brightest person, and clearly lacks insight and wants to be this, you know, Machiavellian master and control everything and make money and get rich and eliminate anybody who's in her way. She just blunders constantly. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you just wonder about if she were smarter, would she have gotten away with more? Probably.
Well, if she's smarter, she wouldn't have to do what she did. You know, we hit this all the time on the show. Smart people don't do these stupid things, because if these people were actually smart, they wouldn't have to resort to doing stupid things.
Exactly.
I would love to see, and I'm so curious about, is who's in her ear? Like, who's telling her, hey, maybe you should do this, maybe you should do that? Because I don't know that Corey's coming up with all these ideas on her own. And I have suspicions there. It will be interesting to see if any of that pans out. Let's watch the rest of this video and the rest of her fine appearance on Good Things Utah.
As a little boy, it looks like he's standing in a hallway at school and he's saying, are you still here?
Yes. Yeah. And it's, you know, and that was like the first day of school and, you know, all the nerves that kids face on the first day of school with new, you know, and just hoping, you know, dad, like, walk with me, like, help me get through today. Like, give me the strength to do that. And it has found, you know, it's been a lot of peace for my kids to, you know, to really remember that in the back of their head that they're never alone, you know. So
you actually wrote this book with your children.
I did.
And it's only been a year. How did you process and say you go from processing death to I need to write a book and help others?
You know, I just watched the struggle that my kids were going through. And I actually, you know, I went on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and trying to find something that we could use to cope at nights. Nights are the hardest, it seems like, for everybody when, you know, dealing with anything. But I just wanted some story to read to my kids at night. And I just could not find anything. I couldn't find anything that really, you know, suited them or helped them find comfort and peace. And so, you know, I was like, let's just write one. And so, you know, I took things that my kids have said to me this last year and we kind of articulated it and put it into a story and, you know, just have hopes that it will help other kids.
Grief is not linear, and this sounds like it's a touchstone when you need it to come back to for you and your boys. So the first one you had mentioned was connection of the three C's, keeping the person's spirit alive. The second, continuity.
Yes, and that's, you know, just making sure you're trying to stay, you know, as much as you can on routine. And, you know, whether that's, you know, sports or pick up and drop off from school or community activities, just, you know, trying to stay in a routine as much as possible.
And then the last C is care.
Yes.
What does that mean?
So, you know, on top of just loving your kids and hugging them and kissing them and, you know, extra cuddles and everything, I think it's important that I've learned to really affirm, you know, their feelings. When they're mad or they're sad, you know, it's just that affirmation of, I understand, like, that you are upset, you know, because of this. Like, let's talk about it, you know. And so I think really it's not, you know, it's the emotional and physical touch of it. But really letting your kids understand that you know why they're feeling the way that they are feeling, and it's okay, and let's deal with it and talk about it.
There's a promotion right now. Get a free copy of the book April 30th and May 1st through Amazon Kindle. You are an amazing woman and mom, and
thank you
for being vulnerable and sharing this and touching the lives of others.
Thank you. I really appreciate being here. So.
Thank you.
I wonder how many criminals show up on daytime television to further their stories. I mean, it's basically, she's like explaining how to manipulate my children. Here's what I did. And I have it with the effect of like, hey, there's Cheetos on sale at the Piggly Wiggly.
Before we get going, she said something that's very interesting in there that's relevant to this. I thought, you know, me doing my research as we're talking. There are currently over 10,000 results of books out on Amazon for kids dealing with grief and the death of a parent.
Not according to Corey.
I mean, there's actually a lot. You know, there's pretty compelling ones. You know, When Dinosaurs Die, Healing Your Grieving Heart for Kids, Fall of Freddy the Leaf, Something Very Sad Happened. I mean, there's a lot on there. So, again, she thought she's some savior for kids coming out writing this book about how to murder your husband and make your kids think you didn't do it.
Let's just write one. It's like, I want to be Joanna Gaines.
There's
so let's just take $250K from my husband and blow it on homes that we're going to lose money
she
on.
She did a
let's
lot
just,
of research, yeah.
Yeah, let's just do it. You know? Siobhan, what's your thoughts?
It's just one of the strangest things. And yes, when you mentioned daytime TV with, you know, murderers coming on, made me think of the guy that went on the dating game.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And got the date. He won. And it turns out to be a serial killer, right?
Bundy, right? California. Wasn't it Bundy that did
no,
it?
No, it wasn't Bundy. I think it was Alcala.
Okay.
Rodney Alcala.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep.
But, you know, on the dating game, they made a movie on Netflix about it. I mean, talk about creepy.
It's like where it's where you least expect them or you would think that they but that's they're hiding in plain sight. And through this book, it was really Corey Richens attempting to hide in plain sight. It was a diversion technique or that she was attempting to employ on her children and on society and on everyone. Look at me. I'm a lovely grieving widow. I just have no emotions. And Jesus, yeah. Your thoughts in the comment section on that video. It's more creepy to look at it now than ever before. Love to get your thoughts there. Nobody marries somebody they believe will destroy them. They marry someone who feels like a missing piece, someone who shows up with everything they didn't know they needed. That's not stupidity. That's how this works. Before we talk about what Corey Richens allegedly did, we need to understand what the beginning of a relationship like this actually looks like, because the people most at risk are often the strongest, most capable ones in the room. And they're also unsuspecting of this type of behavior if they've never experienced before, which makes them an easy mark for folks like Corey Richens. But why? Why is it? Why is it that empathetic, loving, caring, genuine human beings are a mark for certain types of personality? With us to help break all of this down, my co-host, Robin Dreek, former FBI, head of the FBI's Behavioral Intelligence, Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Unit, and Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author. Siobhan, let's start with you. Why is it? Why was Eric Richin such a mark from what we know about his personality, his loving affect, his nature, his goodness with the children, providing for his family, taking care of his family, letting them, you know, doing everything he did? Why is that a mark for someone to just latch onto and basically suck dry like a black widow?
Yeah. Predators have an uncanny intuition for people who have a lot of empathy, people who have a work ethic, people who make commitments and follow through. They have integrity. They try hard. And predators are always looking for what am I going to get out of this deal? Mm-hmm. So they go into these relationships with this, you know, the popular term is love bombing, with mm-hmm. this incredible energy for this intense, passionate connection, trying to read what will feed this other person. And it's very powerful. And it's something that it doesn't have anything to do with intelligence. I know lots of absolutely brilliant, high-functioning people who have been manipulated into relationships with people who were ultimately predators. Mm-hmm. And once, you know, there are all these processes that get going, but it starts with that intense sense of connection and bonding and making the victim feel, I really see you and I value you. They give them lots of praise, and it's a powerful drug.
Yeah, we were getting ready for an interview once of a really high level clinically diagnosed psychopath, and our operational psychologist was with us on our team. And I remember every time we were coming up with a strategy for the dialogue and interaction, we were kept reverting to who we were as human beings to build that connection and empathetic connection, which we will typically do when trying to inspire mm-hmm. someone to share information with us. Mm-hmm. And our psychologist kept reminding us, if you display empathy, they're going to use that as a lever of manipulation against you, because that is actually what these high-level narcissists, psychopaths, and things do, is they, like Siobhan was saying, they identify your weakness to them, and your weakness to them, that is that lever of manipulation, or as Robert Cialdini says, the lever of influence, is mm-hmm. that empathy, because they don't have it. And so they see it as a tool that can be a big lever and can crank yeah. down on as much as they need to. So the more empathy you have, the more vulnerable you are.
Yeah, and they'll also do things like tell things about their past, the hardships that they've gone through, and they weaponize this sense of I'm a victim.
Yeah.
And the empathic person gets really sucked into that. They're compassionate. They want to help them. They want to support them.
Feigned vulnerability.
Yeah, exactly. That's another super common theme.
And it's interesting because empathic people and when they're love bombed, I think to a lot of folks who are empathic and not psychopathic or narcissistic or borderline or whatever, if you're just a very empathic person, that reads to you, if you haven't experienced it before, as, wow, this is how I'd love to be loved. Because I think there's a lot of empathic people who probably love bomb too. Not necessarily, you know, in a way that's for control or some sort of other, divisive reason, but because they're authentic, because when they feel that they're being loved and they're being cared about and they're in that sort of situation, they want the other person to know that, and they want the other person mm-hmm. to see that. So they don't necessarily recognize the love bombing from a character like that as anything other than love. Why is it so hard for empathic people to distinguish between what love bombing is when it is insincere, when it is being used as some other measure that is not love, but is more for coercive control and authentic, genuine affection and love and care that's coming from another human being? What makes it so difficult to differentiate the two?
It's really hard to tell. And I think people who are honest, who have integrity, they're not out there trying to manipulate. Mm-hmm. And so we all project ourselves onto other people. It's just normal. And so when we're honest, when we're sincere, when we feel real compassion and affection for other people, we assume that when they express those things back, that it's genuine. You know, yeah, most of us, I mean, you guys and I, we've probably gotten to the point where we're pretty suspicious in life right now. And we look at everything very closely and analyze, but I don't think most people do. And I can completely understand that. I was that younger, naive person that believed what I was told and what appeared to be genuine behavior. But the other piece, which I find really interesting, is the neuroscience of bonding. Mm-hmm. And early in these intense relationships, in truth, I think most of the time people say they fall in love. Mm-hmm. It's this this neurobiological process where we get flooded with dopamine, oxytocin, and endogenous opioids. And that is the recipe for a drug addiction, mm-hmm. which is why people can be a bit non-rational when they're in the early phases of a relationship. And that may last 3 or 4 months. It may last up to 2 years. We actually title it now with the term limerence, you know, whereas looking at a long-term relationship, those neurochemicals tend to diminish over time and people form those deeper bonds that are long-lasting. But everybody's, you know, subject to our neurobiology, and that's one of my big lines now is kids don't trust the hormones, right? Because they can lead you astray, and it's very possible to bond very deeply with someone who truly has a predatory agenda and isn't going to be good for you.
You know, Siobhan, you really hit that key word right there. Is agenda. And someone who is really empathetic, cares very deeply, and they have life reps of love bombing free of an agenda, so they are actually doing it out of the caring and compassion of others, they don't realize that there are some people like Corey that are actually doing exactly the same thing, doing that love bombing with an agenda. So they're not wholly present or doing it for their gain, not your welfare. So this is the toughest question in the world, or one of them. How do you recognize the red flag between the difference between love bombing with an agenda and love bombing because it's actually caring and nurturing?
Yeah, that's the book we need to write, huh? Yeah. It's tough. I think one of the things that I have found increasingly important over the years is look at their history. What is their history? Yeah. And I mean, their legal history, their financial history. Is there a record of duplicitous behavior? Is there, you know, a really rocky history of relationships? Do they play the victim a lot? I mean, I question those narratives now when somebody comes right out up front and talks about how every awful thing has happened to them, because that can be manipulative. But sometimes it's hard to tell. And I'm thinking of a lot of people I know who are incredibly bright physicians, psychiatrists, you know, people we look at and go, oh, they've got to really be smart. And you know, they are very intelligent, but they can get fooled by this kind of stuff too, because some of these people are just really good.
I was thinking of an analogy, and this is the first time I'm going to try and say it out loud. It kind of came to me as we're going through this, so I hope it makes somewhat sense. Folks that are empathetic are not always the most selective when it comes to discerning what appears in front of them as something good, or someone that needs something. If there's a need, if someone is suffering from something, and you can fill that need, you can help them. You can help them with their traumas, which they oftentimes project early on. If you are really deeply empathetic, you want to be there. Oftentimes through trial and error and life and getting burned, I think a lot of us learn boundaries at some point, hopefully. And we become a little bit more discerning. But early on, you're kind of like a kid at the Sunday bar. It's like you got the ice cream. All of this looks good. You're like, I'm going to put M&Ms, some Reese's, some of these bobas, and you end up with just this pile of shit on your, and it's at the end, you're like, you know, just that those pieces of toffee over there and a little caramel syrup might have been far more satisfying than gummy worms and everything else on here. Or like a buffet at a restaurant. You're like, gosh, this all looks really good. And it's all very average food. And at the end, you know, if I really would have just picked like my favorite thing and just focused on getting that and having that, I would have walked away from this meal much more satisfied and much more fulfilled. But there's just so much, and you're wanting to take it all. And with people, you're wanting to help. You're wanting to be and give yourself in every which way you can to someone that is in need. I kind of akin it to that. And it's an interesting behavior exercise. I'd be really curious as to people with deep empathy, how they handle buffets and how they handle Sunday bars. What that would tell if someone who really loads it up, if that's a really empathetic person, that, you know, just doesn't, can't really solely focus or take some time or just hasn't been burned enough to get there. I don't know. It's an interesting thought process. Mm-hmm. What's your thoughts, Siobhan?
Yeah, I like that analogy. And it's the other thing about it is it's kind of empowering to be that empathic person who's being manipulated, but it's kind of empowering to feel like, you know, I can help here. I can give. And that, for having been in that kind of relationship myself, which I talk about in the book, you get kind of sucked in to, it feels good to be in the position of thinking that you're doing something helpful to someone. Mm-hmm. And in truth, from what we know about studying predatory people in relationships, there's no helping. There's no helping, because the person that you think you are in love with is not who the person really is. And that's another piece of this that's very hard to reconcile.
And I think it's so important, because I think one of the most damaging things that can happen is when you have someone, one of the, I call them life's, the world's beautiful people, the world's beautiful people that are these beautiful, empathetic, give you the shirt off their back, just pour it all out to you. When they get really burned and they get afraid of the world, they get afraid of relationships, they get afraid of engaging, they get afraid to trust people, they've so will, then the pendulum will swing back the other way, and it's so painful, and they get too pessimistic and skeptical of others. I don't like that, because it's mentally for ourselves, for the person that is that empath, it hurts even more when you're doing it to yourself. What I have found, one of the greatest mitigators of most things in life, one, when you're assessing others, you're looking for transparency and that vulnerability, because that's the red flags that I'm doing for, is this someone who's willing to engage healthy? And are they problem solvers or wound collectors, as we love to say? Mm-hmm. And Siobhan, you made a great point on that. Are they seeing themselves as victims and wound collecting? Is that is that their habit, default mechanism? Or, like I like to roll and be positive. And so even when you deal with people that are going to burn you, and you've been burned, I challenge you to don't let go of thinking the best in people. Don't let go of trusting first. I will always lead with trust until I don't. And one way I have personally countered, and I say, I am so sorry, I throw two I statements in here. Give yourself the power of curiosity. When you see, and this, so you add to your life more curiosity and loving critics. Mm-hmm. And so when the loving critic in your life, and this is the person you're going to share things with, share this beautiful new relationship, and that loving critic, they can be extremely empathetic as well. Perfect, great. Or a little more pragmatic. It doesn't matter. But they're not vested in that relationship like you are. So you can share it with them. And when they're telling you this might be a red flag, here's what you don't do. Mm-hmm. Don't dismiss their red flag. Mm-hmm. And the way you do it then is just get curious. Ask the person that you're engaging, that you're pouring out this empathy through, just ask for some transparency. Ask questions. Be curious. And if you're starting getting blocking, blading, avoidance of those questions, now it's time to back off. So, but be positive, man. Human beings, one of the greatest things about even doing our show is engaging in great conversation with other people, so we can recognize, hey, this is healthy, this is unhealthy. I won't judge it. I'm just going to put the nutter. There's my nutter. I had to throw it out once today. Over here.
No, that's excellent advice. And I notice, you know, with the kind of work and the folks I've worked with, and I work with lots of absolutely lovely, wonderful, non-personality disordered people too. But when you work a lot with severely mentally ill and violent people, you develop a level of paranoia. Yeah. And I find that with my neighbors, and it's really funny because my husband is a really friendly guy and he'll be out talking to all the neighbors. And I am very reticent. It's like, you know, boundaries, 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 boundaries. And I have to talk to myself about that, you know, smile and wave. Not everybody is a serial killer in the neighborhood. It's okay. But yeah, it's a challenge to monitor our own thinking and emotional responses to the world.
Your thoughts in the comment section thus far on YouTube and Substack. We'd love to get your feedback on this case, and be sure to press subscribe wherever you are listening. The beginning of these relationships, like Corey and Eric Richens, can feel like the best thing that's ever happened to you. The middle, it's where you start to lose yourself, slowly, quietly, in ways that are hard to name. You're not being hit, maybe you are. Sometimes it's technically wrong. Sometimes something has shifted. You can feel it even when you can't explain it. In the Corey Richens case, prosecutors paint a picture of a marriage where Eric was slowly being drained emotionally, financially, physically, while holding a life together that he may not have fully recognized as a trap. This is the part of the relationship that nobody talks about. With us to discuss, Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, and Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent and chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. There's a pattern in these relationships where the partner who gets targeted, you start to feel responsible for the other's personal emotional state. Like they're always one wrong word away from a blow up. And you don't know why, and you're hoping it's a phase, and maybe this will change, because they weren't always this way. They didn't act like this at the beginning. What's going on now? Well, everybody goes through phases. Everybody has ups and downs. And when you're the partner of that, you're just trying to navigate it. And then you discover, oh, this is more than just like a little like offshoot where we're navigating a small creek for a time. Oh, no, it's the ocean, and there's no land in sight. And there's waves, and there's hurricanes, and there's tsunamis, and the man-eating octopus that's going to pop up at any given time. You just don't know when. I come to it from experience. So when you have that sort of dynamic going on, what's the name for it? I mean, and how does that get instilled in someone when you are the empathic partner, when you're the Eric in this sort of a case, and you are just trying to manage your other partner's emotional state at all times, just to keep the ship afloat, because you're on it and so are your kids, and you'd like to just, you know, enjoy the cruise.
Yeah, I think people start changing their behavior because they're very aware, as you say, a blow up can happen at any time or some kind of emotional outburst. And so they really start to adapt and do anything just to keep the peace. And they feel increasingly responsible for preventing the next blow up. So their lives and their ways of being and processing emotions are altered and transformed. And they start to lose themselves in the relationship. But it's very confusing to see, because predators will give that intermittent reinforcement where it's not always terrible, because they know if it's always terrible, the person is going to get out of it. So it's this back and forth with the loving parts, the manipulative, you know, compliments, the maneuvering, and that alternates with these blow-ups and the criticism and the negative aspects. And it's very, very confusing for the person who's in the midst of it, because they keep wanting to think that the real person is the good one. And it's almost like you have the splitting that goes on between the dark side and, you know, this manipulative, loving side. And in truth, the dark side is who the person really is. But they get very muddled. And they often don't talk about it. They don't get reality checks from other people, because in some ways they're trying to protect the image of the partner. It's embarrassing. And it's coercive control. It's a form of abuse. But people often don't frame it as abuse if there's no physical violence. And even sometimes when there is physical violence, well, you know, she just was having a terrible day that day. This isn't who she really is. And so they rationalize it. And having kids is tricky because it's harder to get out of the relationship. Kids are the connective tissue that keep you there. And it's hard working with people. The other thing I'll throw in is, couples often go to couples therapy, which I have very mixed feelings about, because if you have two essentially healthy people, couples therapy can do wonderful things. But if you have somebody who's predatory, manipulative, and duplicitous, they're not coming in doing the therapy from a place of integrity. And the therapist often is fooled by them because they're so good at masking the dark side. The partner who's being victimized doesn't bring up the dark side. And so the therapist is working in good faith, trying to improve communication skills, you know, problem solving around things that they argue about. And it's not touching what's really going on, because the person is really good at hiding it. And the partner is just confused and muddled. They don't really see what's going on.
So what can you do? I mean, so here you are, the loving critic in, say, Eric's life. Again, we'll do this hypothetical because I definitely don't want to victim blame all the family members because this was so out of what anyone would have expected. But, you know, Eric seeing the warning signs, people like Eric see warning signs. So as that loving critic, counselor, therapist, or just the best friend, father, mother, spouse, what can you say to get someone to take the blinder off, even if they see it but aren't willing to really embrace the fact that, yeah, this is really, really dangerous? How do you get them to take that action or at least listen to the words?
It's really tough because, as I think we've discussed before, if you attack the partner really directly, the predator, people will back off and defend them, you know, right, and kind of solidify that bond. But you have to be confused. I'm confused because you say she loves you, and yet this is what she has done. I'm confused because you believe that she's working really hard, and yet this is what the finances are saying. So I'm confused, I'm confused, I'm confused. And if you're talking to them and you're consistently confused, that kind of puts them in that space of questioning more.
Yeah.
And there are times I have just come out and said to people very bluntly, I am worried about you. And so you can come in with your own empathy and compassion. I am really frightened for you. And in certain cases, I've said, I fear that this person is going to kill you someday. Mm-hmm. Let's plan your funeral because you do not want to get out of it. So what is it going to look like when you die? How is this going to affect your kids? And then sometimes you get this shocked look on your face.
Interesting thought experiment, too. You know, Robin Schummer wrote a great book I really like, Who Will Cry When You Die? And it's a great thought experiment. Then I love your confused. It's a great word to infuse there because it's showing that curiosity, which is very disarming. But then you can, you know, when you're doing that planning, I'd really been curious, like, you know, have that person then say to themselves, all right, we're going to plan your funeral. What would this person who you're afraid of or afraid to encounter, what would they think of if you died? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, so seriously, I mean, it was an interesting thought experiment. So here you are, if you're Eric's counselor and you said, all right, so let's do the thought experiment. You die. What will Corey think? What will she do? What will her action be? And is that then your action that you think is actually healthy or unhealthy for this relationship? I mean, mm-hmm. That'd be an interesting thought experiment.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And sometimes when we don't know how to get through to somebody, when you as a friend or a family member or a therapist, you see things, you just have to try a lot of different things to try to plug in the part of, you know, that prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain. You want to plug that in and keep going back to, you know, you say she loves you, but here's what I'm seeing, mm-hmm. and here's the evidence.
And it's in a very non-confrontational way, which I think is needed to kind of get there sometimes when you're in that situation, because you're not seeing it. And your modality is constantly making excuses, even whether you realize you're doing it or not. You're trying to justify existence, you know, to yourself and everyone around you. But when you're met with the facts of you know, basically, okay, you're chasing this vehicle in front of you that's your lover, this person that supposedly cares about you, and you're supposedly on the same track, but why are they driving ahead of you? And why is someone in the back of that vehicle throwing logs off the back of it towards your vehicle as you're trying to navigate and you're having to swerve? Does that really seem like someone who's loving you? Because this, you're telling me like you're together and things are great. Why are they throwing objects at you that could easily divert you off the road and kill you? You know, being able to get yourself into that situation or into that mindset and answer those questions honestly from a non-threatening way, from a not a perspective of come on, like, because there's going to be guilt, there's going to be shame if a friend is asking this in a certain way in certain situations. But if you can get to that point, you can get to that realization and just get to that aha moment, boom. Sometimes it spiders off and you can see, oh God, it's like the glass just cracked and it's not just one little ding. It's you hit it and then it's spidered out and you're like, oh shit, like this is really, it's quite unstable, far more than I really realized it was initially.
Yeah. For me, in my abusive marriage, which was many, many years ago, mm-hmm. I was married to someone who would say things like how much he loved me at times, mm-hmm. but yet he repeatedly would scream in my face, punch holes in walls, push me around, and try to scare me to death, you know? And those things happened on a fairly regular basis. And if other people had witnessed it, mm-hmm. it would have been wonderful for somebody to say, as I look back now, what kind of love is this? How is this love? Do you mm-hmm. try to scare and intimidate someone that you say you love? Mm-hmm. But I, as many people do, I didn't let the world know about those episodes because he was charming socially and people thought he was a great guy. And so I bought into his story, which if I just hadn't complained about X, Y, and Z, about the bounce check or the credit card bill, or, you know, if I just had kept my mouth shut, he wouldn't have blown up. So,
Siobhan, is that trauma bonding or is that something
else?
Yes,
that's definitely trauma bonding, definitely, yeah. Which I can look back now at this age and phase in my life and go, what the hell? How did I let it get like that? But that's the insidious nature of mm-hmm. this stuff and how some of these folks are so good at it.
Yeah, it is. And it's why they're able to carry it on and why oftentimes they go from partner to partner to partner to partner to partner and eventually die. But you're like, God, look at that tornado. Look at all the damage that they cause in their lifetime. Wow, that was quite a storm. Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube and Substack. We'd love for you to give us your thoughts on this case or share your story too. I've got a great community here that's been through a lot of this stuff. So if you're new to this and you're recognizing some of this stuff, please do, if it's safe, leave your thoughts in the comment section. Every relationship with someone who operates in this sort of way eventually reaches a breaking point. Sometimes the partner walks away, sometimes they get discarded first, and sometimes, in the most extreme cases, the person holding all of the control decides they're not willing to let it end on anyone's terms but their own. Eric Richens, according to prosecutors, was quietly consulting with divorce attorneys and estate planning lawyers before he died. He was starting to find his way out. This part is about what happens at the end. And for anyone in it right now, how to get out in one piece. With me is Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. Siobhan, what typically triggers the end phase in these sort of relationships? Is the targeted partner finally leaving? Is that what does it? Or does the person with these patterns often engineer the collapse themselves?
Well, very often the targeted partner, the light bulbs start coming on. And mm-hmm. it may be that, you know, there's irrefutable evidence about, you know, in this case, the financial things that were going on. I mean, you know, that just became so flagrant. And often they start to set boundaries. They start to set limits. Mm-hmm. And that pushes the predatory partner often into a rage because they're losing control. Mm-hmm. And so things may escalate. And that's one of the dangerous times because you never know when that partner's enraged, what are they going to do? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, that's when violence starts or sometimes murder starts, sometimes murder-suicide. But that's when things can get really dicey. And I think it can come out of the blue. It may be something that you never saw coming. Mm-hmm. But that's the time you find a good therapist or person with a domestic violence counseling background, and you try to go through what are the stages I need to prep in order to get out of here safely and protect the kids and figure out legally what my options are. So it's usually a gradual phase, you know, just like people don't mm-hmm. get married in one day, there's a process. They don't get divorced in one day, there's a process. And you have to often have someone coaching you for how do I do this safely? And look at the finances, look at the custody. I mean, it's really complicated.
I got a quick question about that, with it, because oftentimes with characters like this, the smallest What's your phrase all the time, Robin? Something in the force, the tremor in the force? Is that
a tremor in the force or a wobble?
A wobble in the force, where there's just the slightest. When you decide, I'm going to put up a boundary. I'm not just going to let you do anything you want and just agree with everything you say because I'm fearful of what your reaction is going to be if anybody slightly suggests anything different. If you put up a small boundary, just the small, like, you know what? No, I'm not. That's not going to work out for me. I'm not going to be able to. We're not going to do this, or I'm not going to participate in whatever this may be. Just the smallest thing. Not shouldn't be into a healthy relationship. The partner would be like, oh, okay, cool. Well, you have a great night. I'm going to go do this. But in situations like this, those small little things can feel, I guess, like the end to the partner who is the controlling, monstrous one. And they react as if you just said, here's divorce papers. When you just said, you know what? I'm going to watch reruns of Cheers tonight rather than going out. They will treat it as an atomic bomb going off. So it's very hard, which also then keeps you trapped in those situations because you can't just go to a healthy place and slowly start instilling small boundaries to keep a healthy relationship or maybe elevate the relationship to a healthy place because that controlling partner won't let you put up one barrier. With that being said, it's someone who's in those sort of that sort of a situation, it's very difficult to slowly work your way out because everything is huge. And that's why sometimes it feels like you just kind of go full force, like, all right, well, it's going to be an atomic bomb no matter what. How do you navigate that sort of thing when one person's cognitive distortions are so far out there that they see the slightest demonstration of self-autonomy as the biggest threat in the world to them?
I think in cases, you know, where it's going to be potentially dangerous like that, you have to do it covertly. You know, if you start your own savings account privately so you have some funds, you talk to lawyers, you talk to domestic violence counselors, and you have to keep that secret, unfortunately. Typically in a marriage relationship, I'm not in favor of secrets. I think couples should be honest with each other. But this is a case where you have to keep it quiet and do your plan so that when, you know, I mean, you can just pack up and leave one day if you have the resources. And if you don't have kids, it's much easier to do that. And, you know, so there are cases where it's just like, get out, cut the tie, move out of the house. But when you've got a lot of joint assets, when you've got children, it's probably going to be something you have to do a lot of planning for in advance. And custody is a huge problem with, as you say, you don't want the abusive partner to get custody of the kids. So that takes a lot of strategy.
I'd imagine that, you know, in these cases, as we've been discussing this, you have the imagery going through my mind is like two countries at war on the border. I mean, just think of Russia and Ukraine, right? So you have Russia coming in to usurp land, and then all of a sudden you've got the power struggle. I want that land back. And so two people in the same kind of thing. So you have the supreme narcissist control freak that if the spouse or the partner tries to take a little bit of that territory back, you know, set it in a boundary, and they completely freak, lose their mind, fight battle, and eventually will keep battling until they get their territory back. That to me is that major red flag, that last thing where, like you said, I'm all about transparency, Siobhan, too, because transparency is the great mitigator of all things, right? But at that point, you got to think of it as a spy case, as an operation. When we were working with our counterintelligence spy operatives, we had to create secret exfiltration plans because if the bad guys knew where they were going to go, what were they going to do? They're going to hunt them down and kill them. And Tony, what's the one case? Oh, the millionaire murders, right? What's his face? That the woman, the wife divorced the husband, and then 8 years later, he finally he's being accused of charging.
Teppy.
Yeah, Teppy, the Teppy case. You know, I mean, there's a great example of there's someone actually exfiltrated themselves, but they're still being hunted down because you still knew where to get them. So you got to do the secret exfiltration. We're not saying, hey, run away and hide from everyone.
No.
But you talk to loving critics.
And I feel like a lot of times, you know, because we, if you're a healthy person, you're going to come to it from kind of a healthy mindset, and healthy people can have conversations about conflict, can have resolution to conflict, and can move on and move forward. But when you're dealing with someone who's incapable of that, how important is it to recognize and call a spade for what it is? Because if someone's listening to this and they're already at this end phase and they're like, they don't need more proof, is it completely a fruitless battle to engage that person in any sort of reasonable conversation about fixing anything, about getting anything to change, airing those grievances? I mean, the temptation, I think, in a lot of cases, especially when things get really bad, is okay, especially if the perpetrator here, the narcissist, the borderline, whatever it is attacking and saying horrible things, it is to react, and it is to tell them off, to tell them the reality, to really lay into them. But does that ever help a damn thing? I mean, is that ever the approach anyone should take with a person like this? As good as that would feel in that moment, the damage that that can do and the danger that that can put you into is oftentimes, I guess, from my experience, from everything I've learned about this, it's never worth it. And that's why gray rocking is so important with folks like this. What's your take, Siobhan, for somebody who's listening to this right now in that position, who really is like, I want to tell them what's up.
What
would you say?
Yeah, people try to have those conversations because they want to get through to them. They want to point out their errors. They want to point out how they're wrong. It doesn't work. Doesn't work. And counselors, you know, I have had people in therapy where I get one of the partners alone and say, you know, this, what you're trying to do here, I don't think you should be doing couples therapy because it's not helpful and it's going to make things worse for you. And so what I encourage people to do, as you say, gray rocking, detach, just detach. And if you need a therapist to go talk about your anger and grief and frustration, that's where you take the message and you talk about it privately. But detach from the need to engage with the predator.
Yeah, I'm wholehearted on that one. Don't engage crazy, man. That's my main philosophy in life. Don't engage crazy. You know, those nutters will drag you down because there's, and a lot of times, because, you know, Siobhan, and you said it really good. A lot of times what's driving us to want to engage him and confront him? Our ego and vanity and need to be right, to justify our actions to them. No. Who cares?
Exactly.
You're only doing it for self-gratification. No, stop it. You don't need it. They don't need it. They don't care. Really, the words you're about to say don't matter. There's nothing you could say that's going to sink into them because they are nuts. Don't even do it.
Yeah.
1,000%. And it's hard because that's a muscle in itself that you're exercising.
We want to jam it to them. Yeah. Nope. Let go.
It's just, there's no point. It's hard. It is hard because that is the reaction. But trust me, and I say probably anyone who's been through this, that will not help you in any way, shape, or form. No. Resist and go and find a way to heal and detach. That's what needs to be done.
Don't talk to crazy.
There was another case we were talking about earlier. There's the Kelsey Fitzsimmons case, which woman in jail for 100 days because she couldn't blow into the breathalyzer as part of the terms of being released. She was shot in the lung. She didn't have the ability to breathe into it. But they kept saying, well, part of the release is you have to do this breathalyzer. Well, she's not able to. It's like saying, okay, just get him to swear on the Bible. They don't have an arm. Like, use your right hand. Like, well, just use your right hand to swear on the Bible. Their arm's not there, but they can do it. Everybody has to swear on the Bible. No, they don't. They can't. Doesn't exist. But this is what you need to do. And just kind of getting caught in that loop. Yeah. Get out of the loop. Get out of the loop and recognize the armless person for what they are, because they're never going to swear in that Bible with their right hand. So just accept it and move the F on. Your thoughts in the comment section and on Substack, YouTube and Substack. The links are in the description. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts. We got a great community here who's been through a lot of this stuff too. If you're listening to this and recognizing it and finding it therapeutic and helpful, great. Be sure to weigh in, but we're not medical advice. So be sure to, of course, always consult your own medical experts on anything. All right. Siobhan's book, it is here, Nightbird. You can read all about her adventures in this world. It's a story. Definitely do check it out. Robin's brand new book, also applicable to all this. Good one for Corey. Corey, I hear you're going to be having a little time in prison for a little while. Let me recommend this to you, Corey, as you're Googling yourself, because I know you can't resist and you're watching us tell stories about you and talk about how fucking batshit crazy you are. This would be a great book. It's Not All About Me. I'm sure you'll glean a lot from it. But for those of you who aren't like her, you will. So enjoy. It's available now wherever books are sold. All right. Until next time, for Siobhan, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hey, it is Ryan Seacrest here. Want to bring a little Hollywood excitement to your day? Take a few spins with Chumba Casino's brand new game, Ryan Seacrest's 10K Ways. It's free and features 10,000 ways to play, giving you nonstop action, including thrilling bonus respins and cascading reels. Every spin brings something new, so step into the spotlight, enjoy the excitement, and play today at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey, it is Ryan Seacrest here. If you love great games and a little extra excitement to your day, I got something fun for you. Chumba Casino and I have teamed up to create an exclusive online social casino game. It's called Ryan Seacrest 10K Ways. It's fun and free to play, just like all your favorites from Chumba Casino. And every spin brings 10,000 ways to keep the good times going. Check it out and play for free today at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woo-hoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
What's up, fools? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me about to get them all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Looking for a little Hollywood-style fun? Check out Ryan Seacrest's 10K Ways exclusively at Chumba Casino. There's 10,000 ways to play. Get spinning for free at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Ready to put a little spin on your day? Then check out Chumba Casino's new online social casino game, Ryan Seacrest 10K Ways. It's free and packed with 10,000 ways to play, only at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.